Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching you how to think, not just what to think. This is Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, we have another physicist joining us. We're pleased to welcome Dr. John Bloom to the podcast. Many listeners will recognize that name in conjunction with Biola University, where Dr. Bloom started the Master of Arts in Science and Religion program at Biola's Talbot School of Theology. Dr. Bloom joins us as a visiting scholar today as part of RTB's Visiting Scholar program. So welcome to you, Dr. Bloom.
Well, thanks for having me here today.
All right, Ken, we're going to get into much more bio and so on and so forth as we learn about Dr. Bloom, but take it away. Tell us what we're in store for.
Yes, well, you know, one of the real benefits of having a scholar community and having visiting scholars, and Dr. Bloom is a visiting scholar this week. So it's great to have him come on our Straight Thinking podcast and for our audience to get to know them. And I have a lot of questions I'd like to ask John about science and faith, and I want to hear a little bit about his Christian life. So, John, it's a pleasure to have you, and I know our listeners will really enjoy it.
Well, thank you again for having me here. So,
well, John, tell us a little bit about your own beginnings with Christianity. Were you raised in a Christian home? Did you have a dramatic conversion? What was the process of you coming to know the Lord?
Well, I don't know if I'll give you the long version or the short version, but the somewhere in the middle. I grew up maybe going to church from about the time I was five or six or so. And we went to a conservative, small Presbyterian church that was in a more mainline denomination that had more skeptical leanings. But the church itself was conservative. So I got, you know, did the Westminster Confession and Catechism and so on. And I didn't have any problems with that, you know. But the sense that sort of came, at least it was my sense, I don't think this was the sense of the church, was that, you know, once you sort of, you know, signed on the dotted line and checked the boxes, that you were a Christian, and that was it, you know. And so when I went off to college, it was like, well, you know, is it really relevant? I guess it was probably the biggest thing that I faced. And no real questions are relevant, is it? And, you know, God protected me. I didn't do anything crazy. That was nice. I was a science geek, physics major, and then added chemistry because, I mean, why not, you know? So double majored. And it's kind of interesting how God was just sort of making my life fall apart, not academically, but sort of socially and elsewhere, and just trying to get my attention, I guess. And got into my junior year in a biochemistry class, and my lab partner, I guess the best way to say it, was a real Christian. And we were, this was the first time the course had been taught, the lab had been taught, so none of the labs were working, and I'm just pulling my hair out, just like, you know, what's going wrong here? And they're just calm and peaceful and graceful, and I'm just like, I turned to her one day and said, what's the matter with you? You know, what do you have that I don't, you know? And she goes, well, I've got Jesus. I'm like, but I'm a Christian. And she's like, well, maybe you're not. So then her witnessing line to me was basically this: you've got a Bible, go read it. You know, so it wasn't for spiritual laws or anything like that. So I'm like, okay, I've obviously missed something here, and started reading the scriptures. And not like I'd never done it before or something like that, but it just hit me. And probably the biggest thing was in Mark 5, where the this woman who's been ill for years. And then, so she went to all the physicians and they spent all of her money trying to be healed, and she only got worse. And I just thought, man, that's what I've been doing. I've been looking for peace and security and so on with, you know, with other broken people or with material things or whatever. And I've just missed it, you know? So again, that's what, you know, like that woman, I came to Jesus and said, man, if I'm going to find anything in the world, it's got to be through you, Jesus. And so, you know, came to him at that point. So again, it wasn't particularly dramatic, earth-shaking or something like that, but sort of finally getting the Christian message that it's a relationship with Jesus. It's not just head knowledge or something like that, or recognizing these things, but it's a relationship with Jesus that counts. So that's been my direction, you know, from that point on is, wow, you can know all the facts and so on and recognize that it's right, but where's your relationship? You know, it's not just facts in Christianity, it's relationship with God that counts. So that's sort of my story in a nutshell, Ken. So
yeah, I appreciate it. Let me ask you a question based upon that. How common do you think it is for people, maybe especially intellectual people, but not exclusively, how common do you think it is for people to have kind of an experience with Christianity, an encounter with historic Christianity, maybe even the Bible, but to somehow be disconnected in terms of having a dynamic personal relationship with the Lord? How common do you think that is?
Well, you know, that's going to vary with the person and maybe their upbringing or something like that. I could see, given the skepticism today in our culture, I don't think many people have the basic head knowledge. You know, who's that little guy on that cross, you know, is just a common thing in our culture today. But I still think it's possible for people who maybe sort of, you know, grew up in the church, you know, learned all these basic things and still just it never connected that, you know, it's, you know, gee, the demons believe, you know, that it hasn't affected them, you know, just the strength of that passage. So, but unfortunately, I think, again, in more skeptical groups and our more skeptical culture, I think there is a truth question that has to be addressed as well. Is Jesus really there? Is he someone to believe in, to even have a relationship with? So I think in today's world, we kind of need to be emphasizing both.
Yeah. Well, on Straight Thinking, John, we like to talk about books. We like to talk about people who have kind of influenced us. I know you went to Cornell. Was there a person who was kind of a critical mentor for you in terms of apologetics, and maybe talk about a book or two that has had a big influence on you?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's just fun to look back and see how God has sort of, I don't want to say guided, but yeah, God has guided or directed my paths, because you know, I had Christian friends by the time I left college, and one of them said, oh, you're going to Cornell. Well, you know, when you go, my dad taught there for a few years. And when you go, look up this church, this Faith Bible Church in Ithaca. It's really a good church. So I'm like, oh, okay, you know, whatever. And that was the ministry of Herman Eckelman, who was an electrical engineer and became a Christian, and then, you know, started this very student-oriented, apologetics-oriented church there in Ithaca, ministering to students at Cornell and Ithaca College. So I got connected with the church there. As I said, it was very I guess the closest preacher I've heard to Eckelman is Chuck Swindoll. Okay, just very heart sensitive preaching, very kind of academically focused as well, with a very strong discipleship ministry. So you don't just come on Sundays, but there's, you know, classes in basic Christian living and doctrine and so on. So and a very strong interest in apologetics. So that was, I would say, where I was most shaped in my Christian thinking and apologetics thinking. Another person was Robert Newman, Bob yeah. Newman, who's, sure. again, he's sort of with the East Coast version of Reasons to Believe, the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute. But again, he's a New Testament scholar and astrophysicist, sort of a double background with a strong interest in apologetics and these sort of evidence questions, responding to skeptics kind of questions. So those are sort of the two men that yeah. God used to really have a big influence on me.
What's a book or two that stands out to you as a work that really influenced maybe the way you think theologically or apologetically?
Oh, well, again, for Newman, he's got the book Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, which again is a model for how one fits at least the first 4 days of Genesis with again the origin of the earth models that I think is very good. It's very similar to RTB's model. And then a surprising other book, it's John Urquhart. It's called The Wonders of Prophecy. It's still in print, but it goes back to 1900. Okay, so this is an old book, over a century old. But it looks at Christian evidences, particularly sort of these long-term prophecies that have been fulfilled. And that aspect of, again, key focus in apologetics is certainly the science side and so on, because that's sort of my specialty. But there's also the side of evidence for the resurrection, which Bob Newman has done work in,
yeah,
as well as fulfilled prophecy. Not the Hal Lindsey stuff, okay, the end times, always looking forward, but what have we seen from past history?
Right.
That gives us proof that the scriptures are true. So those are two books that had a strong influence on me, I would say. So.
Now, what is it that drew you to science? Dave Rogstad often says that physics is kind of a foundational area of science. What was it that drew you to that, and then maybe to your second doctoral degree in ancient Near Eastern studies? What was it that lit the fire in those two areas?
Oh, well, I think the science side just came to me naturally. I mean, I was always interested in how things work. And my dad kind of fostered that, you know. My brother and I remember one time he, you know, took an incandescent light bulb and broke the glass off of it so we could see the filaments inside and so on. So just always had a big interest in science and a chemistry set when I was a kid and so on. So that's sort of what drove that, is just my personal passion and how things work and physics, and then chemistry as well, are both connected with that. The theology side and then the ancient Near Eastern side came from, I guess, my science friends. So after I became a Christian, they're like, dude, didn't you get the memo? I mean, you know, science has shown that God doesn't exist, or he's certainly not necessary, or certainly hasn't done anything. So there's sort of this lost people group out there of scientists, technically minded people who've cultures just told them to write off the Bible. So how can I get my friends to think about this seriously? So that got me interested then in apologetics. But then, okay, so there's a God out there. Great, good, okay, that's nice. But who is it, right? So I needed to, I think, get some background in the scriptures and defending the scriptures as, you know, God's revelation to us in particular. So that's sort of what, and Herman Eckelman kind of pushed that as well. He said, you know, you get a PhD in your field, so you're an expert there, but you've only got Sunday school knowledge of the Bible. So maybe you should get some theology training as well. So I and a number of other people went to seminary under, you know, that advice and wisdom, which I think is very good. And then the Old Testament, ancient Near Eastern studies came from just folk, my interest in Genesis and the creation, evolution, science and theology, how do these two interact? You know, most of these issues between science and theology are in the Old Testament. So I should get a good background there. And here's what I found in Old Testament studies. This is kind of surprising to me. But the dominant view in Old Testament studies today is that if it's in the Bible, it's wrong. Okay, presumption of guilt. Yeah. Okay, presumption of myth and legend. Mm. Okay, so if you're going to argue for the truth of anything in the Old Testament, you've got to go to sources that the skeptics and the academics and skeptics will accept, which is, evidence from clay tablets or from the surrounding cultures, you know, that we can dig up. And that then they can accept as reasonable evidence. And then you can use that to say, well, wait, there's aspects here from the archaeology side that can confirm the scriptures. So therefore we can trust the scriptures in this. So I started out Old Testament studies and then shifted over to ancient Near Eastern because that was where the evidence was that the skeptics would give more credence to. So very interesting sort of detour that has been helpful in some ways, I think. So yeah.
I have a question based on what you just said regarding the interplay of science and theology. What would you say is the place for both? A skeptic of the Christian faith on a good day might say these are separate domains of knowledge. On a not so good day, they might belittle the Bible and science and the Christian religion. I think I know how RTB would answer that question. What's the interplay between science and theology? But I'd like to hear it, and I think our listeners would like to hear it from you.
Oh, well, I think I would take a pretty similar approach to what RTB does, is that, you know, here we've got this ancient book. Do I have any basis to trust what it says? Okay. In terms of, you know, historical things, in terms of, you know, science related things. And then if I can trust it there, then maybe I can trust it in these spiritual realms as well. So I think the sort of a multifaceted approach one needs to take, but the science comes alongside and gives one a sense of, you know, there's things here in the scriptures that are not what one would find from the surrounding cultures and the polytheistic worldview, you know, the world around the Hebrew people. And that points to, these people had some sources of knowledge from beyond the world that they lived in. And that you can see elements of from the sciences, say they're in the Genesis creation account and so on. So the overlap between science and theology there's worldview issues in terms of naturalism versus a theism, but in terms of specific things where at the nuts and bolts level they overlap, I think we can see in the scriptures that the right view of things, of the way to think about the world and the way the world is set up, the sequence of events there in Genesis that would not be easy to think up on your own, that gives us that sense of somebody was influencing this, the writers of this, and maybe we should give heed to that. Mm-hmm. So it adds that strength to this is a book you can trust. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, John, let me ask you this. When push comes to shove at the end of your life, I mean, what do you think? Is there an argument? Is there a field of study, or is there some evidence that tends to be in your mind very, very strong in terms of either the truth of God's existence or the truth of Christianity? Is there something that really is probative to you that just kind of stops you in your tracks in terms of the truth of Christianity?
Oh, wow. I think the biggest one is, the evidence for the resurrection. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Apostle Paul said this, right? The truth of Christianity kind of stands or falls on that.
Yeah.
And I think, theologians like Gary Habermas has done an incredible, that's sort of been his main area of scholarship, actually, has been, what's the evidence for the resurrection? And his arguments, you can find and Google him online and so on, I think are pretty incredible. And again, coming at this from the archaeology and history standpoint, the evidence is incredible that we have for, somebody got killed 2000 years ago. Okay, what kind of evidence actually survives for something like that? And then something happened weird a few days later. For any historical person, what evidence is going to survive for something like that? And yet what we do have is absolutely incredible. And Habermas is very good at laying out what are the historical events or facts that even skeptics will maybe grudgingly acknowledge. The disciples of Jesus were convinced that Jesus physically rose from the dead. I mean, just the way their lives were changed and so on. So, and then okay, what was the evidence that we have that convinced them of that? So to me, that's the strongest evidence.
Yeah.
That's absolutely incredible. And I think there have been a number of skeptics who set out to disprove that fact.
Yeah.
Whose minds and lives were changed after they seriously investigated it and realized this is just, I can't deny this.
Right.
It's just too strong a fact. So to me, that would be the big one.
I have a question there. Being in the scientific environment at Caltech and JPL, I have obviously opportunity to communicate my faith to quite a variety of people who are skeptics. Some are out and out atheists. Many are just indifferent. A few have been raised in a Christian environment, but Christian in name only, kind of the experience that you testify to of yourself. And it's hard to get them to pay attention. It's too easy to dismiss the historical event that happened 2,000 years ago written in a Bible that they, you know, it's an old book. Why should I pay attention to that? You Christians can't even agree on what it says yourselves. You know, you have all this controversy and arguments and discussion. Why should I pay any attention to any of this stuff? And so I'm trying to look for things that will somehow grab their attention. In some ways, the material that you have called attention to that you also use, that comes from RTB about, say, the first chapter of Genesis. How did Moses 2,500 years ago or more know the things that he, you know, well, what is it, 3,500 years ago, know the things that he knew to write down what he said? And at least that is something that they're willing to grapple with a little bit. But even that doesn't seem to, you know, get their attention. I don't know. What's your experience along that line?
Oh, well, you know, every person has their, you know, their roadblock, I guess.
Yes.
You know? And you know, in a lot of cases, sometimes God just has to kind of grab them and shake them to get their attention.
Right.
You know, and through some personal issue or something like that, that, gee, maybe I need to reach outside myself for some help here.
So
there's that aspect to it too. So there is the intellectual side of, okay, you're talking about the Bible and about Jesus, but why should I give heed to it? And this is where I think compatibility with science and so on is helpful. I think I mentioned the prophecy side earlier. That's something I found helpful. Again, a skeptic can dismiss anything. That's sort of the dilemma that one faces with that. But the prophecy side, I think, is helpful. That Christianity actually has plausible answers, I think is just a helpful thing to, you know, for people to realize. So this is why, you know, RTB does a whole spectrum of things in terms of, well, what about Adam and Eve and those sorts of questions? To be able to respond to specific things that people might bring up as roadblocks to them considering Christianity seriously. So part of the question, I guess, is to, or the answer is to befriend people enough to know how to scratch where they're particularly itching,
mm-hmm.
You know, because I think everybody will have their own particular problem or issue they might bring up. They might not tell you what it is. They might throw some intellectual-ish question up rather than a personal one. So that's where, you know, for this particular case or this particular question, this is helpful. For that particular question, this is helpful. Coming alongside people on a journey, if you will, is maybe the approach to take there. So, yeah, I don't think there's one thing I learned early on in sort of the apologetics world is there's no silver bullet. This is the argument that will, you know, this is the answer that will, you know, everybody has their own sort of personal questions or issues with God and to come alongside a person and help them address what their issue is, as part of, I think, our task here. So, yeah, it can be. I think it's fun sometimes in that sense of, you know, how can I help this person? On the other side, it's challenging because everybody does have, you know, different questions.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I best respond to that? So,
John, I remember, I don't know whether it was a talk you gave or maybe it was something you wrote, but I remember you said that it's very common for skeptics of Christianity, particularly skeptics of the Bible, maybe even more particularly the Old Testament, for skeptics to kind of quote the liberals. And I after I heard you say that, or maybe I read that you wrote that, I started looking for that. And I find that happening a lot. And maybe the best example of that has to do with the Old Testament, where, you know, I was focusing on the question of slavery in the Old Testament. And I was engaging with a professor at Yale Divinity School. And it became very apparent very quickly that even though this scholar was an Old Testament scholar and had a Jewish background, that I agreed more with Moses than he did. give us a little context for, you know, how you approach the Old Testament. It seems like today there are a lot of people that they think they can just dismiss this book, dismiss the Old Testament out of hand, that it's not something that is compatible with modern day science, and there are lots of errors and problems. How do you navigate that challenge?
Oh, well, I guess two sides. One is to basically start, you know, with Genesis, and man, you know, the story here that people just dismiss as myth. Genesis 1 has this basic sequence, right, and so on. So, you know, despite what people might say about science and Christianity being at war with each other, there's actually this, if you reflect over it, you can actually fit the two together. So showing science compatibility, I think, is helpful in that regard. The other side is from the archaeology side. And here it's sort of fun to see how the skepticism has become dominant even in the field of archaeology. So one thing I do there is try to point that out. Okay, that, man, just look at the bias that's here.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this evidence that could fit very, very well with, say, Joshua's conquest of Hazor. Okay.
Yeah.
And yet you see the scholarly community doing everything they can to find somebody else who destroyed Hazor at that time period other than Joshua and the Israelites. And you're like, you know, after you see a few examples of this, Jericho is another example, where Kathleen Kenyon is sort of dismissed evidence from the time period for the Joshua conquest, and then said, oh, well, it actually happened a century earlier when the Hyksos were kicked out of Egypt. So to present where scholars have taken evidence, you know, not in the Bible per se, but archaeological evidence that is a much more neutral, you know, we dug this up, what does it mean? And you see the interpretation to assign it to anybody other than the biblical account. I think if you can show the bias, that gets people to recognize that, oh, wow. You know, I have to be really careful just accepting what some scholar out there says. I have to look at where they're coming from, what conclusions, you know, what their biases are to evaluate this. Oh, of course, I have a bias too, but we all do. That's what we have to recognize.
Yeah.
And to show some examples where the skeptical bias is very dominant in the academy today, mm-hmm. I think I'll get sort of the honest person to go, oh, okay, maybe there is a lot more to the Bible than what I've heeded, and I just need to be more skeptical of the skeptics. than I have been. So,
yeah, it sure seems that, you know, when we talk about people who adopt a naturalistic worldview or people who are very critical of the supernatural, critical of theism in one way or another, that the idea that they would be biased is almost shocking to them at times, where they're quite confident that religious people, you know, bear a lot of bias in that kind of context. Let me ask you another question here. You know, Dave Rockstad and Joe Aguirre and I, we talk a lot about our discussions with non-Christians. We and of course, RTB focuses uniquely on the, you know, the avenue of science and faith. With some of your colleagues, and I know you have a lot of Christian colleagues teaching there at Biola University, but in terms of your interaction with non-Christians in the area of science, are they more hostile to Christianity or are they more indifferent to Christianity?
Probably more indifferent.
Okay.
I think would be the sense, you know, you always hear about the flaming skeptics in the media,
right?
You know, so, but I think the average scientist, the one that, you know, that I run into is like that, more in that indifferent category, in that sense of, oh, well, you're a Christian. Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, how do you like the coffee? Or, you know, it's just sort of that kind of a sense. So, And it's funny, in a lot of the surveys, something like 40% of practicing scientists are theists,
yeah.
You know, who think there's a God and it's worth praying to him and so on. So I think there's a lot more people in the middle of the road, if you will.
Yeah.
Either the indifferent or just sort of, well, yeah, I think there's a God and that's okay if you do too, you know, sort of a thing. So there's that whole middle ground that one doesn't hear about, but that one can kind of interact with. That's not hostile and maybe even kind of friendly to the idea. But again, in a lot of workplaces, sort of the culture in the workplace is, well, this is not something we talk about here. You know, yeah. So, but personally, I think it's just a bit more in the indifferent category. So,
yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have worked at RTB for 25 years, John, and I kind of divide that period in half. And I say, kind of the first part of my time here, there was a lot of dialogue and discussion between our kind of old earth point of view with the young earth point of view within Christianity. I think, however, the second part has had, I've seen more of an interaction with RTB with what we would once call theistic evolution. Today, we might call it evolutionary creationism. You know, some of the interaction that RTB has had with theistic evolutionists or evolutionary creationists, they're a bit concerned about our concordism. They're very critical of the idea that somehow there is this connection between science and scripture, or that somehow it can be integrated. Do you see that same kind of critique? And do you share that view that science and scripture can be brought together in some form of a concordist model?
Oh, yeah, quite definitely. And I would kind of challenge my theistic evolution friends to say, it seems to me that you're buying naturalism, you know, and to the point that you're not allowing God to speak through the scriptures at all. to anything that touches on the realm of science or history, even in some aspects. So, I think that some level of concordism is very appropriate. It's known as the, this goes back millennia. You know, there's the book of nature.
Yeah.
Where God's revealed his handiwork can be glorified and revealed through his handiwork. And then there's the book of scripture where we have his words through the apostles and so on. And the two should fit together and interact with each other at some level, since they have a common author. But to me, the theistic evolutionist has, the ones that I know have just sort of bought, we have to come up with naturalistic explanations for everything. And to think that God might be revealed in more than a what do you think of it way, that God might be revealed, that God might have interacted with nature in some way that science could detect, is just not on their radar screen. And to me, that's kind of imbibing a bit too much of the world's philosophy of naturalism.
Yeah.
So when I interact with theistic evolutionists, they might challenge me for concordism, but I challenge them for maybe anti-concordism, in that sense of you are intentionally trying to avoid any connection between science and theology.
Yeah.
So trying to rescue theology, perhaps, but I think there's a great weakness in that. So.
Yeah. Kent, if I could come in, I have another question for John. You have a long association with RTB, so I'd like to hear what you want to say about that. In fact, you have written an article for us as part of our Voices channel or blog channel. Our scholars have their own blogs, and we also have members of the scholar community write what's called Voices, a blog that's posted every other week. And you have written at least one article for that. And the title is New Radiocarbon Ages of Dead Sea Scrolls, Part 2. So if you type in those words and search on our site, you'll find Dr. Bloom's article there. But I also want to ask you about the MASR program and how that came about. So your association with RTB and then the MASR program.
Oh, my. Well, I think I was one of the early purchasers of the Fingerprint of God. So so back in 85, 86 or something like that, I was out in Pennsylvania at the time doing my ancient Near Eastern studies stuff. And Hugh Ross, who's this guy? You know, it's like, wow, this is great. Again, sort of the connection through Bob Newman, I guess I would say. Given his astrophysics background. So coming to Biola, now reasons to believe is in my backyard as opposed to across the country, it's just been kind of fun. So I've been able to interact over the years. And it's been particularly nice when we started the MA in Science and Religion at Biola around 2002, 2004. So we're approaching 20 years. That it was fantastic to have Foz and Hugh and so on available in the area to draw on as experts to sort of help with the curriculum and teaching some of the courses, or at least as guest speakers for various things. So it's been nice to have RTB resources and their research, and you know, Foz has taught a couple of courses, Human Origins and so on for it. So to have the resources available for it. So that was that question. You had a second question in there that slipped my mind. So.
Yeah, I think you answered your association with RTB and the origins of the Master of Arts in Science and Religion. Maybe you could, as a follow-up to that, What have you seen over the almost 20 years now of that program's implementation? What are the students going on to do?
Well, it's a range, because we get a range of students who come. Some have finished a bachelor's degree and want to do some integrative thinking before they go on for a PhD or something like that. Others come in sort of maybe mid-career and they just want to be better around the water cooler with their colleagues. Others, probably the biggest group, however they come in, they end up going into some sort of a ministry. Ratio Christi is one. Number of our people are volunteers with RTB, actually, you know, who do the program. So it does have that sort of ministry focus in terms of where people go, which has, of course, been really good.
Wonderful.
John, one of the things I'd like you to talk a little bit about, I've taught at Biola in the apologetics program, and one thing that I kind of emphasize with my students is how important it is not only to grow in your, you know, your intellectual virtues, you know, being tough-minded, being careful, being thoughtful, critical in both self-criticism and criticism of various arguments, but I also talk about the need to develop our moral virtues and our spiritual virtues. And you know, there are times where some of my students are, their intellectual abilities are far ahead of their kind of spiritual virtues. And I try to maybe help them work it out a little bit. However, I would also say that now it seems like we have a church situation where the intellectual life isn't emphasized much at all. And so I kind of see both of those areas where maybe intellectually oriented Christian people need to think about developing character traits that are moral and spiritual. But I'm also a bit concerned that we now live at a time in our culture and even in our churches where the life of the mind seems to be absent. Do you see those concerns that different ends of the spectrum there?
I resonate with that, Ken. By the way, you've been a teacher in the program for us as well, so I forgot to mention you, so sorry about that, those two dimensions, the average evangelical and the life of the mind, don't connect. And this is a bit, again, sort of my Presbyterian heritage, although I'm not today, I'm more in the Baptist world. But nevertheless, Presbyterians have historically had this rich academic background and life of the mind interest. You think of Boyce, 10th Press there in Philadelphia, and so on. So yes, there's a need for the life of the mind among conservative Christians today. But then also it's not just the life of the mind. Yeah. There's also the whole personal development. Like I said, that was my own sort of story. Gee, I've got the head knowledge, but where's the relationship in the heart? And this is one thing where being a part of the MASR, being a part of Talbot has been really interesting. We revised the curriculum in the program just about 2 years ago. It's called the Psychology of Belief. Okay, it's the name of the two courses that students take. But that's the focus of it, is to develop your personal belief, your personal relationship with God, and the ethical, moral side to that, of course, is a component to it. But yeah, it's very easy as a seminary student or in any academic theology focused program to just go crazy with the head knowledge and sort of leave your heart behind. Yeah. So Talbot is, all the seminary programs associated with Talbot have that heart dimension to develop your personal walk with Christ as well as, you know, the head knowledge. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's a real weakness that you point out on both dimensions. So much of the Sunday morning focus, worship focus, is just on an experience, but not on the head knowledge and not on really the how's my walk. So yeah, those are two aspects that I resonate with on you.
You know, you talked about the resurrection being such a powerful force in terms of looking at the truth of Christianity. On the flip side of that, John, is there an area of challenge that comes to Christianity that we have to wrestle with? Is there something that you would identify as maybe the major challenge of our faith, that, you know, that you would contrast with the resurrection?
I think that the biggest challenge we already kind of touched on, I think it's just broadly skepticism about everything.
Yeah.
You know, and that it goes back to the garden. Right? You know, what did Satan say? The serpent say to Eve? Did God really say that? Right? No. You know, to get us to doubt what God has said. And it's entrenched in the academy today. It's entrenched in our culture today. And I think that's just skepticism about everything is what we have to always be, and again, that personally, you know, affects me as well. You know, so how do I know that that's true, and how do I know that that's relevant, and so on? That to me, it's not a specific area; it's just this blanket that dampens everything,
right?
You know, that I think is sort of the biggest challenge we face.
Well, very good. John, tell us a little bit about your family. I've met your wife, and how long have you been at Biola now? I thought I read 27 years. Has it really been that long?
Well, it's now, I'm in my 29th year, depending whether you use cardinal or ordinal numbers. Okay. So, but yeah, it's somewhere around my 28th or 29th year there.
Wow.
So that I'm wrapping up. And live a few blocks from campus, so it's easy to get there. That makes it nice. I'm one of 10 people in Southern California who do not have to commute to work, you know? So my wife and I, my wife's a librarian, and she volunteers at Fullerton Free Church in Brea. They're in the library, the church library that they have. And my son is, he's a computer geek or nerd, whichever is the appropriate term. And with COVID, it's a bit tough, but he's looking for a job. But he loves working on PCs and Macs and so on. So he lives at home with us. So that's the family.
Well, very good. How can people find out more about your program there on science and religion? And is there a web page that they can contact for that? And do you have a personal web page where they can find out more about you?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you just Google science and religion Biola, you'll get the web page for the MA in science and religion and the various information related to that. I've got my own webpage. It's drjbloom.com, drjbloom.com, that has some old pictures of me and so on, but at least it'll give you some links and resources that you might find helpful as well. So, yeah.
Well, very good. It's been a great pleasure having you, Sean, and really appreciate you being a visiting scholar at RTB. So thank you again.
No, it's again, fun to be here. So.
All right. Thank you for listening to this podcast. We've been visiting with Dr. John Bloom. Again, the webpage he mentioned, drjbloom.com. Check that out when you can do so. And let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken via his Twitter handle at RTB_KSamples. Don't miss any episodes of Straight Thinking. You can subscribe to the Reasons to Believe podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts, and you'll get an episode delivered to you each week. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.